Thank you, Tim. And now we'll hear from our next speaker, Chris.
Oh, thank you. Where's the beer?
Thank you, President Ochoa, for inviting me here. I have to say, I'm a little intimidated and nervous being on the stage for several reasons. One is I have to follow Tim Rainey, and I don't have nearly as good jokes as he does. And part of the problem is I'm an economist, and you know the kind of person who becomes an economist, that's someone who's good at math but doesn't have an entertaining enough personality to become an accountant. No offense, President Ochoa. I know you're an economist also. It doesn't apply to you either. The other challenge, of course, is that I'm the university professor on this panel, sandwiched between two practitioners who are actually on the ground listening to employers and workforce providers or being an employer. And so I guess my role on this panel is to say, you know, Tim, that's all very well to work in practice, but does it work in theory? So I guess I was put on this panel in part. We had this kind of logical order where Tim was going to talk about the statewide plan and the vision and the direction things were going. I was going to talk about sort of the regional processes and patterns and sort of bring it down to that level. And Rick Antle is going to be talking about sort of the experience on the ground, planting in the ground of labor. It's very dangerous, though, to ask a professor to say what you want them to say, because, of course, professors aren't used to saying what others want them to say. So I took this opportunity to think a little more broadly about building a workforce for the 21st century economy, and I promise I will ground it in the region. But I want to talk a bit about workers in the 21st century, work and what that looks like in the 21st century, and then a little bit about markets, and particularly labor markets as the primary institution that is really designed to help facilitate labor's contribution to our economy and growth over time. So first is just a reminder, in California, we became a majority-minority state in roughly 1998, so about 18 years ago. Just in the last year or two, Latinos passed non-Hispanic whites as the largest racial group in the state. And by 2040, you know, 40% through the century, over half the population of California will be Latino. When you look at Santa Cruz and Monterey County, we're even more predominantly Latino. So in 2010, it's about 47% non-Hispanic white. This is the core workforce, sort of 25 to 64 population. But again, majority Latino by the end of this decade. And then when you look at the youth population in the region, those who are the future workforce, we're already at those under 18, 65% in Santa Cruz and Monterey County are Latino. At least, and growing to 75% by halfway through the century. And so one of the key messages from that is that if we want to be thinking about preparing a workforce for the 21st century, probably the most important priority is early childhood education, right? Kids before kindergarten getting the preparation so they can get into the school system and get the effective growth over time. And of course, we have to be thinking about the full life course, but investing at that early stage is absolutely critical for our Latino youth in the region. Now, one of the challenges we face in this transition that Tim talked about of baby boomers retiring and younger generation coming in is what my colleague Manuel Pastor calls the racial generation gap. And this is a chart that shows in the red line for California, that top line is the percentage of the senior population that are white, non-Hispanic white. That bottom line is the percentage of the youth population who are non-Hispanic white. So we have a predominantly community of color of youth populations, and we have this gap in the racial percentage. What's critical about that is if you look at the size of that gap, the disparity in the racial composition of the senior population to the youth population, and compare it to per capita spending in public education, those places that have the greatest disparity in that racial generation gap are the ones that spend the lowest money on public education. And there's California right down near the bottom. And of course, you can imagine why that's the case, is because those who are, you know, more senior and elder leaders in our society are the ones who tend to vote more frequently. They're more active in leadership. And they don't have kids as much because they're beyond that stage and have less of a sense of the priorities in investing in public and higher education. And I think this is part of the reason why, even in our higher education systems, the community colleges, CSUs, and the University of California, why we're facing some of the financial challenges we're facing at the moment. It's the racial dimension of that. So when we're thinking about preparing a workforce for the 21st century, we have to think about racial equity as a critical component to that. So let me talk about this second issue, which is thinking about the transformation of work that's going on. And if you can imagine 40, 50 years ago, whether it's a GE or General Motors or US Steel, you know, the technology wasn't changing, the work was continuing through, you can have multiple generations in the same factory doing the same kind of work. But imagine the companies of today. You know, Uber, which claims it actually has no employees, they're independent contractors who are driving the cars. Airbnb has every night 1.5 million rooms that are rented out. In 35,000 cities, 15,000 cities around the world. It's double the size of Hilton, the largest hotel chain in the world. And yet Airbnb has about 2,500 employees. And Hilton has not 10 times, but 100 times as many employees. So what does that mean about sort of the type of work? Well, one thing to think about is the educational requirements. And we often talk about the importance of higher education. And yet when you look at the jobs that are actually being created today, only about a third of them, that's that top line, the black line, is the percentage of jobs needing a bachelor's degree or higher in California in the next decade. It's only about 36%. So that means there's a lot of jobs out there that require middle skills, maybe an AA degree, some kind of technical skills, as well as a lot of jobs that are being created that don't require that level of higher education. And it's interesting to look again at the racial dimensions of the educational attainment of our population in California. And again, seeing in those middle categories there, the Latino population, US-born, and Latino immigrant population with much less educational attainment compared to what's required in the job market. But what's clearly shifting in terms of the jobs that are being created is that if your job is routine, and that doesn't mean necessarily just routine physical labor, it can be routine mental labor as well, it's being automated and computerized, increasingly intelligent machine learning and automatic algorithms. What this chart shows is in those red lines, the net job change in both manual and cognitive jobs that are routine. And essentially all the net job growth since 2000 has been in jobs that are not routine, that require some creative thinking, creative engagement, where the work day to day is different. Now, it's interesting when I saw this next slide, which shows the percentage of jobs in a metropolitan region that are in that routine category. And it turns out that regions that have a higher percentage of jobs that are in routine occupations are predominantly Republican voting regions in the last election. Now, this is a correlation, not causation, so I'm not trying to make any jokes here about Trump or anyone else, but I think there are some interesting correlations between the level of economic insecurity and people's concern about where our country is going and what kind of solutions out there they're looking for. So this has really important implications for our whole society, not just the labor market. Now, one of the issues, of course, is then as we're talking about the 12 jobs that all of you students out there will have before you're age 25 or 26, was it, Tim? Which jobs are going to be available 10 or 20 years from now? And when you look at the jobs that are out there of what could possibly be automated, replaced by computers or robots or machinery, it's a very interesting study here that was quite interesting looking at last night at the bar after a drink or two. This is an effort to try and look at all the occupations in the U.S. economy, and on that X scale, to assess the extent to which they're likely to be automated or computerized in the next 10 to 15 years or so. And so on the far right scale, you can essentially say these ones over here on the right are the ones that are most likely to be automated sooner. You know, it's roughly, if you look at that 70%, 0.7 mark, about 47% of all employment in the U.S. is in occupations that could pretty easily be computerized and automated in the next 10 or 15 years. So those are not the jobs you want to be aspiring to if you're a student. So the fear, of course, is that, you know, the robots are coming, technology's coming, this is a problem, it's displacing work, what's the work of the future going to be? And of course, this isn't the first time in human history that people have been concerned about technology and its impact on work in the labor market. Many of you have probably heard of the Luddites. The Luddites have a reputation of being anti-technology. It was at a time when machines were being introduced into the manufacture of textiles in England, and workers smashed the machines that they, in theory, were interpreting as replacing them in the jobs. Turns out, so on the left there is Ned Ludd, whose address was his office in Sherwood Forest, which should raise some questions for you. It turns out Ned Ludd was not a real person. And the Luddites, in fact, were not protesting technology in the work. It was a time of major economic insecurity, at a time when technology was being introduced in the textile industry and rapidly expanding the number of jobs that were available in the industry because it was reducing the cost of producing the goods. They were concerned about the low wages and working conditions and the ways that some employers were bringing in new workers and paying them lower wages, and so they were smashing the machinery to protect that. And it points to the importance, in my mind, of not demonizing technology, because technology is just, you know, utilized by different people in different ways and has the tremendous potential to increase economic output and productivity and job creation, but to pay attention to our social and political institutions that determine who's benefiting from these economic restructuring. And as we look forward at new jobs in the economy, we often get told or talk about the importance of STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. There was a very interesting study by an organization in Silicon Valley called Institute for the Future that was really trying to look at major disruptors in the economy and what are the kinds of skills that would be needed in the 21st century workforce. And the kind of things that they identified were not so much the STEM fields, although in fact the STEM fields underpin all of these. But it's these things like sense-making, the ability to determine the deeper meaning or significance of what's being expressed, social intelligence, novel and adaptive thinking, cross-cultural competency, the computational thinking, cognitive load management. This is what I need to figure out, is how do you interpret all the information that we're being bombarded with every day and discriminate and filter it for importance and understand how to maximize our engagement with that information. And these are the kinds of things that you have to learn through practice, through engagement. Much of it actually gets trained through engagement with the humanities and arts and music. And so we need to understand that it's not the narrow, repeatable, routine science and technology and research that's part of that, but this broader set of skills. So coming to that kind of last topic I wanted to look at, which is thinking about markets and the labor market that, you know, Tim's really talking about the state trying to help organize and, you know, what are the institutions that can help make this better connection between job seekers and people who have jobs to offer. This chart I did not design myself. This was actually put together by three Nobel Prize winning economists who won the Nobel Prize for looking at markets with significant friction in them. But the labor market is a complex, maze-driven place. But if labor markets are working properly, there's essentially two things they should do. One is help direct people, labor to those productive areas of the economy where it can lead to job growth, where it can lead to economic growth, where people can, you know, make a productive contribution to the economy. And jobs are the primary way that, in theory, we distribute the national income, the wealth that's produced, to individuals. So how are we doing on that first category in our new knowledge-driven economy that's so different from the manufacturing economy of the past? Well, first is to recognize that, in fact, our economy has become much more sluggish over the last 50 or 60 years. What this bar chart shows is the average pace of economic growth, annual GDP growth, by decade. And in the 50s and 60s, we used to average, you know, 4 to 4.5% growth a year. By the 70s, it was dropping to 3%. We're now at a place where 1.5 to 2% is essentially a good pace of economic growth in our economy. So why is it that we aren't growing so fast? And of course, there's lots of debates about it, but I wanted to highlight a couple different things. One is to think about the largest economies in our region, our largest companies in our economy, in our region, and to understand, well, why is it that Apple is so valuable? And when you really dig deep into the origins and the development of the iPhone, and this is not my work, this is a work by an economist named Mariana Mazzucato, who wrote a book called The Entrepreneurial State. And what you realize is that most of the major technological advancements that underpin the iPhone got their start in public sector investment. Much of it through the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, actually. CERN is a Swiss-based research institution. In many ways, the public sector serves as a very early stage venture capitalist, investing in the development of major cross-cutting technologies like the internet that are far too risky to invest in at the early stage of development for a private sector investor to get in. But the challenge we have is that the incentives for the state to invest in this early stage development are not well structured, because the state doesn't take an equity stake in the further development of this enterprise. We assume that that gets distributed through society, through companies that build on this technology and make the wonderful new products like the iPhone, and then, you know, the public sector takes that out through taxes. But part of what happens in this process is that a few different companies are taking advantage of what are essentially economic rents, technological rents, and making tremendous profit out of that, where you have actually the majority of the society who are not benefiting from the technology in the profits that are generated from it in the same way. So there's a lot of something we have to think about of the distribution of that technological advancement. And here's another example of thinking about what makes Google and Amazon and Facebook and eBay and all these other companies so valuable. And at least part of the value that's created through them is their ability to connect people and the contribution that we all make as consumers to the value of their product. Now, if you think about consuming a refrigerator or an automobile or something like that, you add no value to the product by your consumption of it. But every time you search for something on Google and click through, you're adding value to Google's product. Every time you, in fact, drive in your car and your GPS is tracking your movement, and then that allows Google, through the telephone companies, to show traffic patterns on the road, you're adding value to that process, through Facebook, through all those things that are going on. And yet there's no mechanism for us measuring the value created that we as consumers, not as workers, but as consumers, provide to that thing. Now, of course, we get great free products like searching for Google, and that works fine as long as enough people have jobs. But if value in the economy is being created not just by labor power, but by consumer power and social networks and the ability to communicate and connect with a variety of different people, how do we recognize that in the livelihoods that people have? So finally, that second part of what labor markets should do is distribute national income broadly in a way that people have decent livelihoods. And I could bore you for the next probably hour with statistics about inequality in the country. I bore my students at Santa Cruz with that for actually a whole quarter on these kind of statistics, but they pay me for that privilege, so I won't bore you for that long. But this is just a basic statistic of the percentage of total income in the country that's captured by the top 10% of income earners. And the key point is that we're at points of economic inequality in this country that we haven't seen since the Great Depression of 1929. But part of my argument is that this is structural in many important ways. And there's a couple of different ways to think about it. One is that when you look at companies that are some of the largest employers and most valuable companies in the economy today, you have a company like McDonald's where its average revenue per employee is $60,000. Right? There's no way McDonald's can raise their wages dramatically to provide a decent livelihood in a fast food restaurant unless we're going to dramatically increase the price of the Big Macs that we buy. And yet you look at a company like Facebook and their average revenue per employee is almost $1.5 million, right? And that's structural. And then we also have to think about, well, what are the things in society that we need that are continually going to be there regardless of the high-tech products and, you know, services that are being created? Food is one of the critical aspects of that. How many of you can imagine an economy without food being produced and distributed? Yeah, no? One out of six private sector jobs are in the food system from farm to fork, to restaurants and grocery. But here's part of the challenge. Eight of the 10 lowest paying occupations are in the food system. Most of those are in restaurants, not in the fields, right? It's the dishwashers, it's the bussers, it's all those things that are going on. And one of the things we actually desperately need is improved productivity throughout the food system. Increase the application of technology to increase the profit margins and improve that over time. But food, education, healthcare, and if you look at the largest growing occupations out there now, home health care, home health aids, similar, somewhat low-paying healthcare jobs are a key part of that. So how do we deal with these structural inequalities? There's also an increasing disconnection from overall productivity in the economy and what labor is rewarded for that. I mean, if you look from the 1940s up to, you know, roughly today, productivity growth for labor has been roughly continual across that. And from roughly the 1940s to the early 1970s, the average compensation for labor paralleled almost exactly. But as we started entering this knowledge economy, and there's a bunch of other things going on with declining unionization rates and growing deregulation, wages for workers have stagnated over that time. So we're seeing greater inequality in that sense. But the final point about sort of thinking about the conditions for workers and preparing a workforce for the 21st century economy is to look at, well, how do people actually survive in this economy? What are the livelihoods that people have? And of course, wages are still a very large part of overall livelihoods, but it's now down to about 50% of total personal income that comes from wages and salaries. So what is the rest of the pie? Well, of course, some of it is the benefits associated with work that are now tied predominantly to the workplace, to a job, but in this world where we're constantly moving from job to job to job is less efficiently done that way. So that's healthcare and other benefits. This one is, what is that one? Income on assets, so it's returns to capital in different ways. This is Social Security, and then there's a variety of other sort of small business sectors. But part of the point there is that we need to be thinking about livelihoods, not just wages and salaries. So now that I've probably discouraged you dramatically, continuing on Tim's, you know, great inspirational theme, I also want to talk about some solutions quickly. The first thing is, coming from completely different directions, we've similarly converged on the importance of regional leadership networks, regional knowledge networks. The book that I just released last fall with Benoit Pastor is called Equity, Growth, and Community. We were looking at regions across the country that were successful in both above average economic growth and above average social equity metrics. And it turns out that those regions that are particularly successful have very dense and diverse knowledge networks between different constituencies by sector, by industry, by public, private, nonprofit, et cetera, that allows them to promote greater innovation, to identify new and diverse economic opportunities, which, by the way, much of that is international. Our growing middle class in Mexico and Brazil and India and China is a tremendous economic opportunity for this country, and we should be promoting immigration that facilitates that. But critically, too, is the ability to respond to economic restructuring in a coordinated, collaborative fashion. So we're not wasting time fighting over how are we restructuring and developing, but can recognize through detailed knowledge, through information, what's going on in our economy, and direct resources to those sectors that need support and need benefits in ways that simple labor markets will not. If you're interested in this book, it's actually available free. We're busy sharing knowledge at that website, growingtogethermetro.org. I think the second thing is to really think about how do we expand what academics call the social wage systems, the various ways that people have livelihoods in between and outside of regular wage labor or salary labor. So, of course, Social Security, one of the most popular federal benefit programs, is a key part of that. Healthcare is a part of that. We need to ensure universal health coverage that's not linked to a single job so that people can move around. And I should mention that people who study this say that one of the major obstacles to entrepreneurship in this country is a workplace-based health system. Because the most successful entrepreneurs are people who are, you know, in their 30s or 40s, they have some experience, they have some connections, they're ready to jump out on their own. But when healthcare is super expensive and you have family to support, or maybe you're beginning to worry about your own health, that becomes a barrier to people willing to take the risk to start new businesses. Housing is a critical part of that, and we need to expand our affordable housing system overall. Higher education, you know, we pay for free higher education through grade 12, and that's been in place at a time when a grade 12 education was a pathway to a decent job. And today, you really do require an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree to have, you know, a higher paid position, so we should subsidize education more. People are even talking now about a universal basic income, an idea that's been around since Thomas Paine and our founding fathers and has been advocated for by both the left and the right of the political spectrum. So it's worth considering. And finally, as we think about training people for jobs in the 21st century economy, I think we need to not think about training. We need to think about learning and lifelong learning. And what's required in that process is the networks and social relationships and connections across boundaries that allow people to learn and understand what are the new directions the economy is going and how do they learn from others about the new skills that are important and really building those networks. And I'll just mention the program that I run at UC Santa Cruz, the Everett program, which focuses on this connection between digital tools and technology and social innovation. Tries to do this with working, this is just one example, of working with high school Latina girls in Watsonville, where one of the things we've done is focus on knowledge about how to get into college. The College Mentor app is an app that you can download on Android or iOS that high school girls from Watsonville wrote, programmed in a week, without any previous programming knowledge. Because they come in and get motivated by learning this knowledge, and they're learning not from some professor. They're learning from undergraduates at UC Santa Cruz who just the year before were in their same circumstances. And they're programming the app geared for their peers in the school. And so they can organize and think about it. How do you organize this information in a way that their peers can understand? And so it's that peer-to-peer and what we call near-to-peer learning that is really critical. We're doing some new app development work now about new technologies in the food system, including ag tech, that we're quite excited about moving ahead. And so with that, I'll thank you for your time and attention. And if you're interested in that Everett program, there's a website. And look forward to your questions and answers in the next session after Rick has a chance to talk. Thank you. Mm-hmm.